Spoilers, The Final Frontier. These are the episodes of the podcast Storm of Spoilers, its continuing mission to explore strange new media in the off-season, to seek out new information and speculation, to boldly spoil like no pod has spoiled before.
After a time, you may find that having is not so pleasing a thing after all as wanting. It is not logical, but it is often true.
The enormous danger potential in any contact with life and intelligence as fantastically advanced as this. But I must point out that the possibility, the potential for knowledge and advancement is equally great.
Risk is our business. That's what the starship is all about. That's why we're aboard her.
Hello and welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers off-season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez and I've searched my soul and I am a red shirt helmsman ensign from the Next Generation era.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I didn't know we were doing this. I will say I am a blue shirt science officer from the Next Generation era.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I am also a blue shirt science officer, but from the Kelvin timeline.
Oh, damn.
You're listening to A Storm of Spoilers, the podcast that is usually about Game of Thrones, but this week will be about Star Trek and San Diego Comic-Con. Actually, in that reverse order, just to be confusing. Basically, we're going to go and talk a little bit about Comic-Con, the things we learned about some of our favorite properties, some of the properties we might be talking about in the future, and then we're going to segue into talking about Star Trek Beyond, which we all saw, Star Trek Discovery, and the future of Star Trek in its 50th anniversary year. It's going to be a whole bunch of fun. But first, do we have any reviews this week?
Guess who's not ready for this part?
We might have some reviews.
Do we have any reviews this week?
We do.
Number one. Reviews.
Number one. This one comes from Hooper's X. From these here United States. They say, 5-star, love this podcast. As a non-book reader, I love this podcast. Even the smug, sometimes arrogant Joanna Robinson is awesome. Parentheses, joke. During Game of Thrones seasons, my week is never complete without listening to Storm of Spoilers. And then another one from Game of Thrones fan, 5 stars. I mean, we're getting nothing but 5 stars, so it feels a little like self-congratulatory at this point. I'm not asking for negative reviews. I'm just saying. This one says, good review, wonderful insights. This is a good show. The hosts are prepared, opinionated, and they stay on point. I love the stalkerish nature of the spoilers. Casting calls are scrutinized. It adds to the fandom. This podcast is a service to fans of the books and show. Well done, friends. So yes, please do not leave us a negative review.
The hosts are always prepared. Parentheses, joke.
Parentheses, hardly ever. Okay. That's my section. The reviews done.
Yay. And then because we began as a Storm of Spoilers, a Game of Thrones podcast, and we're only on an extended off-season tour, let's check in with Nail, the Maester of Citadel, the Citadel of Crazy Town. Good Lord, Dave. Because he has the Game of Thrones news.
Well, we had a few ravens land on the boat. Have we named our boat yet?
Oh, no. We should name the boat.
We should name the
boat. The SS Franklin, right?
Not this week.
This week it could be.
But so the first raven is all about a little bit of production news. At Comic-Con, they did show a video. I think they showed that at Comic-Con, right? The video about the production starting up. Which is basically just like, hey,
props.
All the people that work behind the scenes to make all the little details of Game of Thrones have already gone back to work. The actors have also been spotted traveling toward Belfast. Gwendolyn Christie and Ian Glenn, both kind of on their way. We're guessing, and Joanna can tell me if I'm wrong in this. We're guessing it's mostly for costume fitting this early because they're not starting shooting for a little while. But yeah, this is good news for our guy, Jorah.
Liam Cunningham said at Comic-Con that they would be starting filming on August 5th, I believe it was. So they're not starting filming for a couple weeks. The Watchers on the Wall, which reported the news, they theorized costuming, which is a good theory. Another good theory, I think, is fight choreography, because Ian Glenn gave an interview around season 5 where he talked about how he started on his fight choreography like a month before production and even before he got a script, he was working on fight choreography. So that's a thing that they do is they go and they practice their fight choreography, which might explain why Kit Harington was in Belfast last year, like way before filming started. If they go and they work on their stunts.
He did do some fighting, a lot for a dead guy.
He was up and moving. Yeah, he sure was. I don't know if you guys have seen that I think it's the behind the scenes of Battle of the Bastards where he's training in his skinny jeans. It's the best thing I've ever seen. Kit Harington doing like dueling in his skinny jeans. So Ian Glenn and HBO would like me to tell you that it's possible Ian Glenn is going to Belfast for another project. But the fact that he was spotted on a plane with Gwendolyn Christie makes it feel like this is Game of Thrones related. And also someone who's Facebook friends with Brian Cogman, which I am not, claims that he posted on his Facebook page that he was also in Belfast. So it seems like, you know, everyone's
doing
sort of
Star
gathering.
Wars reshoots in Belfast and Ian Glenn got added to Star Wars Episode 8.
I mean, that's kind of the dream.
Right.
I'd be okay with Ian Glenn in Star Wars.
He's like Captain Phasma's buddy.
Yes. That would be so good. But anyway, I feel like we weren't too concerned that Jorah wasn't going to come back. But this just feels like the nice bit of confirmation that, some Jorah fanatics, I don't know who they would be, but some people who are fanatical in their love for Jorah might be excited to hear this. So
what would you call a Jorah fanatic?
Jorah Revenant. Oh, I'll work on it.
All right. We got to get that ready for next season.
I'm sure all of Twitter will tell me I have two things I have to address. This is out of order probably. One.
Give us Mormont. Okay. Maybe. Sorry.
Give it Mormont. I like it. Yeah. That's like how my friend nicknamed Mae Whitman Moore Whitman because he always wanted more of her in Parenthood.
Yes.
This is better. Okay. So two things. On Twitter, everyone chimed in to tell me that I was kind of dumb for not being able to think of a G word for New York when Gotham was sitting right there. So, Ghostbusters is goo, gang, gadgets, Gotham. There you go. So that's a correction from last week's Ghostbuster episode. And then the other one is the Cary Elwes question from last week's episode. Is Cary Elwes actually British or American? It looks like I was wrong. I don't want to admit to being fully wrong. Cary Elwes is born of an American and British parents,
I
believe.
He is whatever you imagine him to be.
He grew up in England, but came to the States at 18 and lost his accent. So when you hear him talk in interviews, it's with an American accent. But the reason he can do such a good British accent is he lived there until he was a late teen. So that's the Cary Elwes, all the Cary Elwes news that's fit to print.
I would like to say something embarrassing that is going to completely cover up all of the mistakes from last week's episode. Specifically about the Gotham thing. Up until I was about 23, which is far less than a decade ago, I was thoroughly convinced that Gotham was named Gotham and it was based on Chicago and not New York. To the point where I actually got into arguments with people when they were like, oh, well, that's what they call New York Gotham. I'm like, no, Gotham is Chicago. And that's the most Midwestern thing that I've ever done in my life.
I think that's cute. That's like what are the fictional kingdoms in Princess Bride? It's like floor something. My sister and I loved the book, the Princess Bride novel by William Goldman growing up, and it's written as if it's like if you've read the book, it's written as if these places are real. So, like, there's author's notes about the real kingdoms that's not translated to the film. And so my sister in, like, a geography class in middle school asked to do the countries from The Princess Bride as if they were a real place.
I'm going to do
Florin and Gilder. Exactly. She thought they were real places up until, I think it was, like, seventh grade. So,
nice.
Good times. All right.
All right. Now that we've got all that baggage out,
we can move on with our lives.
We can. There's a good way to pivot to this. Joanna, you were actually at the Game of Thrones panel in San Diego last weekend. You know, I imagine just basking in everybody's charming personality and seeing videos of props, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Everyone was pretty charming, especially Faye Marseille, who plays the waif. She's the loveliest lady. And if you've seen her in other things, she's just got, like, the best, like, most, like, guttural northern accent, and it's really delightful. Yeah, the Game of Thrones panel is quite famous at San Diego Comic-Con for not revealing anything. They used to do casting announcements, but it's been a couple of years since they've done those. So they reveal nothing, even less than The Walking Dead did. I mean, they haven't started shooting yet, so we can forgive them some of that. But so I think the most revelatory thing that happened in that panel is we got a clarification of at least what Sophie Turner's understanding of Sansa's attitude towards Jon is, which is that she thinks Jon is dumb, that she should have gotten all the credit for winning the Battle of the Bastards, that he's uncouth, and that she should be the one leading Winterfell. So if that's, once again, this is just Sophie Turner's interpretation, but if that's her interpretation, then I feel like that final look between Littlefinger and Sansa is very much a, like, I should consider him being my ally going forward. Mm. I feel like the script is sending us mixed messages on Sansa's feelings, but I really do feel more convinced than ever that we're headed towards Sansa working against Jon next season. So,
to make her a super likable character, everyone's gonna love that.
Yeah,
that was
I know.
Sarcasm.
I know.
Parentheses joke.
And then I will say that, you know, the 6,500 people in Hall H chanting "Hold the door" when Christian Nairn, who plays Hodor, like, was starting to talk, like, he got, like, choked up. It was really, really, because he's a big softy, so he got, like, really emotional about everyone being so invested in his character. So that was very charming. And then I think the Charlie Day Rob McElhenney like, little video that they did for Comic-Con went up online, and that was pretty cute too. So yeah, that was the Game of Thrones panel. Uninformative, but kind of delightful. Yeah,
it's going to be really interesting next year at Comic-Con when they're in the middle of a season to see if HBO even brings Game of Thrones.
I know. I bet they skip it. What I will say, something that Comic-Con did is they scheduled the Game of Thrones panel and the American Gods panel back to back, like, you know, and the Game of Thrones panel started late, so they actually ended up overlapping, and they were in opposite ends. Like, Hall H is downstairs and on the left hand side, and the place they had American Gods was upstairs on the far right. So there was no way you could go to both panels. And I think they did that on purpose in order to sort of split the crowd. And, you know, cause there's interest was high for American Gods at Comic-Con. Mm-hmm. So to sort of make the fervor less intense is to split the audience. I did go to both panels, and that involved me shagging ass all the way down the convention center.
Was the
and
American
like,
Gods in like ballroom 20?
No, ballroom 20 is just upstairs. It was It's in ballroom 6, which is upstairs and across all the way across, like, literally the opposite end. It's the third biggest venue. It really should have been a Hall H panel, but you know, I think I know why Comic-Con did it. But yeah, I shagged ass across convention center and then blustered my way into the panel, which means I missed the trailer the first time they played it, but I saw it at the end. And then of course it went online. So we are definitely doing an American Gods episode. Dave is just gonna have to grin and bear it. I'm so fucking excited for that show.
I'm reading a book for it.
I know. Neil bought the book, so he can be a smug book reader just like the rest of us. And you guys should all buy it or listen to the full cast recording audio to get ready to be a smug book reader. Because this is, like Neil Gaiman said, he's writing a second American Gods book. There's already a Anansi Boys, which is like a spinoff book. And they said during the panel that they would be incorporating stories that Neil Gaiman never got into the first book. Like, there are these Coming to America sections about the immigrant experience in America. And he said there was one about a Japanese internment camp that never made it into the final draft, that he was like, it would make a good season two episode. And so, like, they're going to do stuff like that. So they're going to, this is not just going to be a one season show. This is going to be at bare minimum three seasons. They've got a plan to split it up. So.
I can hear Dave's eyes rolling all the way back into his head.
Maybe he actually is going to like the show, because sometimes they make great, great filmed products out of books we don't necessarily like.
That's, you know, true. And I do like Brian Fuller and his complete season plans. That's worked out well for me with Hannibal in the past.
And Brian Fuller said the thing that Dave likes so much about Brian Fuller is he says that the way he approaches adaptation is that he basically does fan fiction. And I think it's going to be less intense than it was with Hannibal, less intense of a rewrite of American Gods. But they're still kind of, you know, I talked to a lot of the actors who have their characters are bit players in the book, and they're like, oh yeah, I'm in a bunch of episodes. Like, they're mixing it up. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. I'm excited though.
Nice.
And Dave, they talked about Pokemon Go. I already told you that they talked about Pokemon Go, but that at least appeals to Dave.
Pokemon Go.
How many Pokemon does Brian Fuller have?
Brian Fuller, I think, is like opposed to Pokemon Go only because he sort of gave a slight finger wagging conversation about putting down your phones and making eye contact with the world. So
interesting.
But that wasn't about Pokemon Go. That was about just like being on your phones in general.
Oh.
So
I mean, the one I want to know is Rian Johnson definitely plays Pokemon Go. What level is he
I
at?
Know
how many that
yeah, how many Pokemon has he collected while shooting episode 8?
Yeah, and he's got all those space bear Pokemon. Maybe actual space bears. We don't even know. We have a couple of questions for you, Joanna, that Neil has come up with. We're going to, I guess we could all give an opinion on some of these, but definitely yours is going to be the one that counts. What was the best presentation atmosphere of the stuff that you saw?
I'd say like the most, I don't know, personally, interpersonal best was the American Gods panel, because they talked a lot about love and connection. And no, I have three answers. Okay. American Gods. Yeah. Because it got like really, I mean, I love Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman got the biggest round of applause, and like writers never get the biggest round of applause. So I thought that was really cool. And, you know, they were talking a lot about like love and connection and the toxic world that we're living in right now. Yvette Nicole Brown of Community fame was the moderator versus Chris Hardwick, who moderated like almost every other panel that I saw. And she was just amazing. And like both she and a member of the cast read out like a Neil Gaiman quote that meant something to them. It just like felt like very emotional in that room. The biggest spectacle was Marvel, which, you know, literally did like a smoke and light show situation. And then like for Guardians, I mean, that was just like a production. It was impressive. And then, I don't know, kind of the coolest environment was the Luke Cage panel. I mean, Netflix introduced, you know, revealed a lot of stuff, which was interesting, but like also, the number of, Comic-Con is a lot of white people. The number of black people who were in the room for Luke Cage and just vocally very excited about Luke Cage was really cool to see. So, I thought, yeah, those three panels. Sorry, I cheated my answer.
No, that's good. Pretty much, like, what I found from the single time I've attended Comic-Con is sometimes atmosphere-only events are, like, hard to recount, but will always be, like, the weird memory things you return to. Whereas, like, you know, sitting from the outside, I'm like, and then they revealed Defenders. That had to be awesome. But maybe not the most awesome thing for everybody.
Well, and there's always the panels that feel better in the room than you would have imagined having heard about them later.
Sure.
Yeah, Luke Cage, I think, was kind of a low priority to a lot of, at least, writers that I talked to about when we were trying to figure out our schedules and who's going to what, like not a ton of people wanted to see, and the room was not full for Luke Cage, but Netflix just brought it because this is the first time at Comic-Con, and unlike a lot of the shows that don't feel the need to like Game of Thrones or The Walking Dead, don't feel the need to share a lot of information. They were like, let's give you a lot of information. It's going to be great. We're going to show you some Iron Fist stuff. We're going to show you some Defender stuff. I wish that had happened in Hall H. Like the roar would have been insane. And it was still really exciting in Ballroom 20. So
that's awesome.
Yep. Yeah.
Netflix might be a future star of Comic-Con.
I think so. Like, I think if they keep doing it on that level, I think they'll graduate to Hall H and they'll, yeah, exactly.
As long as they don't put it on Saturday in between WB and Marvel, I think that'll be fine. Because already it was like hell covering it, because you have Warner Brothers in the morning and then the CW panels back to back to back to back, and then Marvel. It's a lot of superheroes. But I do want to talk about, I guess, the difference, because you were in Hall H for both the Marvel and the DC panels, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so for DC, they like released all of their video if you wanted to see all the DC stuff, Justice League, Wonder Woman, which looked much better than I was expecting it to look a few weeks ago. All got released online. Marvel made you put down your phones, so you piracy is at an all-time low. James Gunn was teasing some sort of new technology. I didn't see any evidence of that from where I was sitting. But what did you see that was so secretive? Spoilers.
Well, yeah, I wanted to address. We had a tweet about this where someone was angry that Marvel hadn't put that content online. But I want to say that I think it is cool that the studio had something for the people. I'm the jerk who doesn't have to wait a long time in line because I've got my press pass. But like, there are people who sleep out overnight to get in that room. And for the Marvel panel especially, the people who are in there are usually people who slept out overnight, got in there that morning for the Warner Brothers panel, so 10 a.m., and stayed in Hall H, which reeks of nacho cheese and like pepperoni and BO and despair, and stayed there until 5 p.m. when the Marvel panel starts. So like, you're there all day. You have put the time in. So I think you have earned some like privileged content. I earned nothing. I didn't do well. I was in Hall H all day, but like the fans, they deserve something. I think so. So that being said, what did I see? I saw a Doctor Strange trailer that I guess didn't make it online. I saw a really Taika Waititi did an amazing like What We Do in the Shadows / SNL sketch about what Thor and the Hulk were up to during Captain America Civil War. And it was so funny. It was so Taika. And it like makes me really, really optimistic for Thor Ragnarok. Cause basically like Thor is wearing board shorts, Thor costume on top of board shorts on the bottom. He's got a whole yarn wall about like, what are the Infinity Stones, with just like Easter eggs all over the yarn wall, like little post-its of stuff. And it's like, there's like a rundown of Thanos, and it's like, what do we know about Thanos? Big, purple, doesn't like to stand up, all these little things that is just like so funny. And then Thor has like this ordinary roommate who lives with him, who like is trying to vacuum the floor, but Mjolnir, the hammer that I just like boned name on, Mjolnir, is in the way, and he can't like vacuum around and he can't move it, obviously, and stuff like that. And then like, there's a whole joke about how Thor is trying to get in touch with the Avengers, but no one's returning his calls, but they will call Banner and they don't want to talk to him. And so anyway, sorry, that was long, but that was really funny. I really hope that gets released online soon, because it's not a spoiler. I just hope they keep it like a Comic-Con exclusive for like a while, but then I hope you guys all get to see that. And then we saw like a rapid cut of a lot of in-production stuff for Thor, including animatics and actual like green screen, people shooting things. We saw Cate Blanchett as Hela. It's Hela or Hela? Hela. Hela, right? Yeah, Hela is to Northern California. Hela, where she's like, there's like flames behind her, and she's turning around, and she's got all those antlers coming off her head, just like she does in, like, you know, the sketches you've seen. And she's all dark. She's sort of like dark Galadriel mode. And she turns around and she makes like this, like, evilish hand, like beckoning hand gesture. And you're just like, oh my God, Kate Blanchett. I didn't see any of Tessa Thompson in any of that footage, so I don't know what her character looks like. You see Jeff Goldblum sort of sitting, presiding over the games that we know are coming.
Does he
you
look
see
like Jeff Goldblum?
He, or is he blue? I don't remember. I always feel like I let Dave down because they don't let me take notes while they show this stuff, and I never remember enough for Dave. As Dave reminded me, Thor gets a haircut in the next movie. They shave his head, give him a buzz cut. Hulk is in battle armor, gladiator armor, and you see him fighting. Yeah, so that's what I saw for Thor 3.
Took me four to five years to finally see that Hulk in gladiator armor.
But Planet Hulk, Dave has been saying this has been coming for a long time. Okay, so that's two. Guardians of the Galaxy 2, you might have seen that they brought the actors out who are playing Ravagers. Who are playing the Ravagers. So, like, we met the Ravagers in the first movie. They're Yondo's guys, so we get more of them in this movie. So the actors came out in full costume and makeup, and it was pretty charming. And then the cast came out. Kurt Russell came out. And they showed a whole scene of a jailbreak with Baby Groot, who is, like, even cuter than you could possibly imagine, and Yondo and Rocket trying to break out from where the Ravagers have them. And Yondo has this head fin, which... some people on Twitter, you know, were saying to me, like, the head fin is a thing that you need to wait until Guardians of the Galaxy 1 is popular before you go full head fin for Yondo in the second movie. But that's where, like, the head fin has to do with his arrow that he can whistle and, like, make kill everyone, right? So he kills a bunch of people, all set to... Come a Little Bit Closer by, I think it's Jay and the Americans, which is, like, I'm presuming is on volume 2. Then, Kurt Russell avoided saying that he was playing Chris Pratt's father, but that lasted for all of, like, 5 minutes, because then they showed us, more footage, like a sort of a trailer. Where Kurt Russell's character gets introduced and he's playing Ego, who's a living planet. And, he says in the footage, like, I'm your dad and I made myself into a human so I could have sex with your mom and I made you and there you go. So that was a big surprise to a lot of people except for Dave, who knew that was coming. But a lot of people were like, Ego, the hell? We saw Nebula and Mantis. Mantis is not green. Mantis is flesh colored, but she does have little antenna. Elizabeth Debicki, who plays the leader of the Sovereign People, is entirely gold. So she's covered in gold paint, and she's pretty great. And there's a great, like, little throne room scene with Rocket, like, being snarky and her not having any of it. Yeah, and then that footage was played The Chain by Fleetwood Mac. So I would say that those two songs are probably on Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 mix, to give you a sense. I think Dave and I have argued in the past on Thought Bubble about what we thought would be on Volume 2.
Yep.
So
thus far, none of us have been correct, but
right.
Okay. We haven't heard all of it yet.
Those are two potential songs. Okay, what am I missing?
I don't know. I think that was all the exclusive stuff. I think we got vague ideas of, because then the Captain Marvel reveal was all that was left of that
right.
panel, I believe.
So. Yeah, and that happened. They debuted their new logo, if anyone cares, which no one does, and gave out hats that had their new logo on it, if anyone cares. I did not. And I talked about Doctor Strange, I think, a little bit. Oh, and Black Panther. They announced that Danai Gurira from Walking Dead is going to be cast in that. So that cast looks
and solidified the Dora Milaje, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That she's the leader of, and Lupita Nyong'o is a member of the Dora Milaje, and that cast is, like, the most goddamn attractive cast you've ever seen in your life.
They are a handsome group.
Yeah, they really are. And yeah, and the mood was just great. I mean, it's funny because last year they weren't there. And so last year on Saturday, the day started with Warner Brothers and ended with 20th Century Fox. And it was sort of a similar situation where 20th Century Fox just had like so many goddamn stars on that stage and had to take an enormous, enormous photo with like all the X-Men and Ryan Reynolds. And
they even had Channing Tatum, who's not even in any of their movies.
Exactly. And so they did the same thing where they ended by bringing everyone out on stage. And it's just kind of incredible. Like if you were following along at home, you're like, oh, Tilda Swinton's there. Oh, Michael B. Jordan's there. Oh, you know, like it's God damn it. Yeah, it was pretty fucking incredible. So I was way more amped for that presentation than the Warner's presentation because of my natural bias. And also because the Warner's presentation wasn't just the DCEU, but it was also like the goddamn Guy Ritchie King Arthur movie. And, well, Harry Potter, that was pretty cute. And, Lego Batman and Kong. Lego Batman is, anyway. So, yeah.
What? Sorry, you're not into Lego Batman?
We can fight about this sometime.
We're going to do a whole Lego Batman episode.
It's what I deserve for making Dave talk about American Gods. Yeah, I feel like I'm talking too much. Sorry.
No, you were the one who was actually there. I mean, there are other panels that I heard about, but I don't think you saw. So, like, I know Neil and I are interested in Rick and Morty, and they had a panel where they didn't really get to announce anything, but they did show a clip where Rick has been turned into a pickle, and he attacks a whole bunch of rats in an action sequence. It was pretty badass. And then they had a live panel that had some surprises. They improvised an episode, which, you know, if you want to find that on Periscope, it's on Periscope. It's really just for the Rick and Morty diehards. But then they also had a clip of the Georgia courtroom viral thing that they showed.
That might be the funniest YouTube thing I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, you definitely have to. It's like life wrote for Rick and Morty, and they figured out that, you know, that gift was bestowed upon them. So that was great. And then Sherlock, which I'm a big fan of, so is my girlfriend, so therefore the household is a big fan of.
I like the Sherlock.
I like the Sherlock. I will say that I think it's been diminishing returns. Like, it started stronger than it is right now, but I do like it.
Well, what I'm excited about is it sounds like they're going to actually try to change the character, you know, to show his decisions growth upon him. Yeah, his growth as a investigator or, I don't know, functional sociopath.
We should do a Sherlock episode. When does that come back?
That's a good question. I think they were finishing up filming season 4. Did they announce an actual time that it was going
to
come out?
They didn't announce a date. They said they had 2 more weeks of filming to do. But traditionally, it's around Christmas. So that's what I would expect.
Yeah,
that it's going to be around Christmas, January.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. But the trailer for it looks dark. We're going to have a dark Sherlock season. So it's going to be interesting to see if they could justify the arc from, you know, the study in pink or whatever the kind of flighty first season episodes were, all the way through whatever this, you know, chunk of dark Sherlock's going to be. But I'm excited because we get a lot of iterations of Sherlock Holmes, and not a lot of them live long enough to change. I guess Hugh Laurie's house did, but not for the better. So, you know, it could go either way. I'm excited, though. I'm always good to see more Sherlock. And there's like a weird photo floating around the internet that I found of Doctor Strange stepping out of 221B Baker Street, and I can't tell if it's photoshopped or not. So it's like everything in my mind's collapsing in on itself.
Does he then also turn into a pickle?
Well, man, that would be crazy. Or it would also be crazy if he ends up in 221B and Tony Stark's there for no reason and they just share a weird look and fuck off. And just be like, oh god, and my mind would tear open on the spot. It'd be crazy
when expanded universes collide.
Expanded universes collide. We have a few more questions. Joanna, what was the best meal you had in San Diego?
Let's see, I knew this question was coming and I didn't prepare an answer for it. I mean, it certainly wasn't anything I ate in the convention center, because I didn't eat much in the convention center. Oh, I had a... Yeah, there's a place called Seersucker on 5th and something, where I had a brunch and a lunch, and they have great Comic-Con themed drinks there that are like classy kitschy. So I definitely had like an ectoplasm shot out of a little like crystal skull glass. So that's the best meal I had. The best party meal I had is at the Stars American Gods party. They had Jello shots with little like pop rocks on the top. Let me tell you, I never want to have a Jello shot again that does not have pop rocks on the top.
Whoa.
The little bit of texture just makes it all the better. They also had little mini margaritas in tiny, tiny, tiny glass bottles of Patron, with little straws, which is just like Joanna Kryptonite. So that was an interesting evening for me.
I've heard a lot of different things you can do with pop rocks. This is a new one.
Yeah.
It's delightful. I had no idea it was coming, and there it was. So
nice. One of the surprises of Comic-Con.
One of the surprises of Comic-Con. What was the best moment that no one tweeted about? I guess you might have tweeted about it if you thought it was that good. So if only you tweeted about it, it still works.
Or maybe something that like happened outside the convention hall, or you know, something that maybe not is like part of coverage. Because I know Comic-Con's very good for that kind of stuff.
When Joss Whedon touched me? No.
Sometimes that's all it takes.
When I will say I was having drinks with some female geek pop culture writers who you probably know, and Max Landis walked by and we hissed. That was my favorite Comic-Con experience.
That's exactly the kind of moment I was hoping for when I wrote that question.
he was also at another party I went to, which was by a pool, and he was right on the edge of the pool, and I was like, I could push him in.
I could be a hero right
happen.
Now.
apparently at that party, I didn't see this. I did see Jeff Loeb dancing, like getting down at that party, but also apparently James Cameron was also seriously getting down on the dance floor, but I did not see that part. So that's allegedly. All right, next question.
It has been alleged.
I guess as a way of transferring out of the Comic-Con and into our next topic, there was a Star Trek 50th anniversary panel, and it sounds like Brian Fuller was just in like a general let's talk about how we need more love in our life mood, because much like American Gods, this panel, yeah, which you could hear online, I believe the Engage official Star Trek podcast put it out as an episode, is... Brian Fuller's really letting his allegorical Trek love show throughout the whole thing. Whether or not that works with everybody else is sort of touch and go, but I did get to hear Brent Spiner's Patrick Stewart impression, which thrilled me.
Pretty solid, right?
Yeah.
It was pretty great, yeah.
Part of me,
yeah,
is...
and also I realized that I did not know what Michael Dorn looks like outside of his Worf makeup. For all that I love Next Generation and like Deep Space Nine, he walked out. I mean, I knew Michael Dorn was on the panel. They walked out. They said Michael Dorn, but I was just like staring at his face, being like, "Let me find the part that I recognize. I can't." So yeah,
your head is relatively smaller than it usually is, Mr. Dorn.
Well, why so few ridges on your head? But yeah, Brian Fuller was amazing. And I did talk to him later about that panel, and he made a very salty joke about William Shatner, and he said that was the only part of the panel he remembered because it was just a big blur to him because he was so sort of like overwhelmed by the whole experience. So, I mean, Brian Fuller has done plenty of things. So the fact that he could feel that kind of, you know...
euphoria
that he could geek out with the rest of us, I think bodes really well for the Star Trek series. For those of you who don't know, Brian Fuller like got his start as a Star Trek writer. I think he said, Dave has listened to it, so maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he said, like, I didn't want to be a writer when I was growing up. I wanted to be a Star Trek writer. Like, I think that's a quote from that panel. So
he came up a lot like how Ron Moore came up. And except Ron Moore went on to create the new Battlestar Galactica after executive producing a whole bunch of Trek series. But Rod Moore came on just as a sci-fi writer in like season three of Next Generation and ended up sort of going along Trek and then spinning out. Started on Voyager and then went off to do his own thing. And now he's coming back sort of at full power, which is going to be sweet.
And Jaina Svendsen, too, who's a Buffy writer and has done a number of other things. She also got her start on Trek. Trek was a good incubator for TV writers, I think, because, and they've all given interviews about this, I think because the format of the show allows you to pitch a number of kind of stories, you know, like the joy of the holodeck and like all sort of things, you know, you can pitch like, it's genre television, but Star Trek is genre television in a way that like you can land on any planet and the options are sort of endless. So I think it gave them all a lot of room to grow as TV writers.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Before we get into Beyond, I want to stop and get Star Trek. It's Storm of Spoilers due. Neil, how did you get into Star Trek? How into Star Trek are you? Give us a portrait of the Neil, the Trek fan.
So I am really a TOS kid. I think we talked about this at the end of last week's episode, but my mom grew up watching the original series with her dad, and so that was the one I kind of glommed onto as a kid. And I think I lost track of Star Trek for a long time. So I watched a lot of old TOS stuff. I'd watched the old movies, but you know, my attention went elsewhere when it came to Enterprise, Voyager, Deep Space Nine, pretty much all the other modern movies. And really didn't get super back into it until 2009 when they rebooted it. And I've started to go back through and look through the some of the stuff that I've missed, but there's just so much. And so it's tough to catch up, but always a huge place in my heart we went to this Star Trek event where they premiered Star Trek, the 09 Star Trek in Austin. So if you guys remember, they did this screening where they were going to screen Wrath of Khan, and they, about 20 minutes into the movie, the reel burned up and Leonard Nimoy showed up. And
what?
He was like, wait, hold on, I have the new movie right here. This was like the first screening ever of that movie. And so we were sitting in the like reserved area because one of the Paramount publicists had emailed me and she's like, hey, you need to come to this Wrath of Khan screening. And I'm like, I've seen Wrath of Khan like 100 times. She's like, no, you need to come to this Wrath of Khan screening because trust me. And so my mom was in town here in Austin and I took her and we ended up sitting... It was me and then my mom and then Leonard Nimoy watching Star Trek 09.
What?
It was like the coolest thing that's ever happened.
Oh, that's such a cute moment.
And
oh,
I think my mom leaned over at one point and was like, do you think I should try and get his number? Like, all right, go mom.
Your mom's so baller.
So that Spock would be great.
Oh my God, the best. Even weird photographer Leonard Nimoy would have been great. So
tell me about Bilbo Baggins again, Dad.
So yeah, so that's my Star Trek history. It's not as robust as most people, but it there's family lineage to it, which I think a lot of people's Star Trek stories have.
Yeah, well, and I think you got closer to Leonard Nimoy than the rest of us. I think we started off in people who've gotten close to Leonard Nimoy. Joanna. Start Trek me up. I mean, okay, wait. Let me go first to sort of like set some boundaries. I talked a little bit about my parents liking it, but I'm definitely Star Trek wise a memory alpha person and not a memory beta person. So if it's a show that I could revisit, or you know, if it's the Next Generation that I now realize in hindsight was triggering my ASMR as a young child just by having constant noise and focused attention. Or you know, if it's a cartoon, I'm all in. If it's a novel, if it's a video game, I never really connected with that like I have with other properties. Give it your Star Wars or your I don't know, Myst. I read all the Myst books like an idiot. But mine's always been completely based on shows, and I think it's my generation didn't have, you know, like science fiction magazines, and we didn't have the internet. We had Star Trek, and it was the late 80s, early 90s, and it started to be everywhere, and Star Trek conventions started to become like a thing, and we started to debate whether we wanted to be called Trekkies or Trekkers. So in terms of how I engage with a fandom, Star Trek was probably my first one of those, but it was like Star Trek and X-Files were my pre-internet internets, where you would have to like find people who were as into it as you were, like in real life. I've never been like a Star Trek online or a crazy person who knows about William Shatner novels. That's where my Star Trek line is. Joanna.
Yeah. Okay. So I definitely grew up watching some of the original series, because I distinctly remember when I went to a new middle school in like fifth grade. The PE teacher had a Star Trek like club. He would dress up in a Star Trek uniform every single Halloween. He was like this tall, lanky, Vulcan looking fellow. And he had a chess club and a Star Trek club. And I was definitely in both of those because I was really cool. And the Star Trek club was very small.
Have you played 3D chess?
No.
Mm-mm. Oh, damn. I thought that would be okay. That Venn diagram you were setting up was a 3D chess Venn diagram.
No, it was normal chess and an original series Star Trek. But my true love is Next Generation. Anyone who has listened to me ramble before knows that I've watched a lot of different television growing up, but my sister only watched one show, and it was Star Trek Next Generation. And so this was like the show we watched together. Whenever it was on, she got control of the remote, given like the sheer volume I watched and the one thing that she watched. So we watched that together. She watched more DS9 than I did. I think I trailed off on DS9, but yeah, Next Generation, I think, is one of the greatest shows ever. I love everyone in that cast. I have like very strong memories of a lot of episodes. First Contact is my favorite movie. And yeah, I think what they did with that show and the enduring legacy of this franchise is something really incredible in a world of sci-fi that has become so big. But at one point it was like Star Trek. Star Trek was this like outlier, and now it's one of many, 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 many options out there. So yeah.
And it's reinvigorating itself, or attempting to, even though it turns 50 in September, with a third movie in the Kelvin timeline, which is what we call the J.J. Abrams timeline as of 3 weeks ago. I'm not going back and editing anything that I've written. It still can be the Abrams verse if you need to call it that. And as we said, Brian Fuller is going to do Star Trek Discovery, which is going to be on CBS All Access, which is cool in a lot of ways. A little bit of Star Trek history. So Star Trek Next Generation was the first straight to syndication television show, which means they pitched it to the network. They were pitching a whole bunch of stuff. Gene Roddenberry was, including, like, you know, another phase. It was called Star Trek Phase 2. And then, obviously, they decided to take the original cast in the movies after Star Wars made it. So they're like, hey, these original cast movies are making some money. Maybe we could do a next generation Star Trek. And they went around and pitched it, and all the networks said, no, you're absolutely crazy. But based on the name Star Trek alone, they were able to sell it directly to submarkets. So the CBS channel in Georgia, or in the CBS channel, you know, in the Montana, individually, until piece by piece through the first season, they covered most of the United States. But it wasn't like a single deal, like an upfronts these days, where the network comes out and is like, we've ordered a season of this and you're going to have to live through it one way or the other. It completely sort of made itself through syndication. It's now looking like they're going to try to do the same thing with Star Trek Discovery, but for streaming. So in North America, we're going to have to all buy into CBS All Access. The first episode is going to air on CBS to set the lure, but then the consecutive episodes in this story are going to come out weekly and only be on the streaming app. Unless you live outside North America in which case Netflix is going to get Star Trek Discovery episodes 24 hours after they're released, which is goddamn amazing, and I think the thing that's going to push Star Trek Discovery and CBS streaming like Next Generation pushed syndication. That was a lot of history, but it's goddamn important history because Star Trek like built it.
I've heard Dave give this speech like 5 times and that like it gets better every time.
There's so many more details that I even left out in that thing.
So you think it'll be good for CBS streaming despite the fact that in order to get CBS All Access you have to pay extra even if you have cable?
See, I'm skeptical and Dave is a believer.
I did it for Supergirl and I was disappointed about halfway through. So unless Star Trek Discovery is amazing, which I hope it is.
It might be, yeah.
Then I think that it could be potentially harmful to the way CBS does it, as opposed to like the shows that go to Hulu within 24 hours and air on networks and stuff like that.
Sure. I mean, the interesting thing is that they're sort of making North America their test market. Obviously, the cheapest way to deal with this is to wait till it's all over and subscribe for 1 month and binge it all, because that's going to definitely be possible. But I think the thing that makes it sustainable is the Netflix deal worldwide. So, like, our Australian friends, our New Zealand friends, our European friends, they're going to be the people that actually make this show monetarily successful. Whether CBS could push a streaming platform in North America, I view as like a separate thing. I don't think it's gonna have Star Trek Discovery is gonna have to hang its hat on this particular business model being successful in this region, or at least that's the hope. I think Star Trek's big enough to do that, and I think it's one of the few franchises that is.
What's interesting is that Fuller said in the panel. I mean, Fuller unveiled the design of the new ship. Which I guess a lot of people hate. I don't know. Looks like a ship. I don't really care. but Fuller unveiled the design of the new ship. But he also said, I think the only other useful thing that he said was that the series was going to be not as episodic as Star Trek has been in the past. So he says the episodes are going to be like chapters in a book. So, you know, and then Shatner's like, what do you mean? So I mean, if someone misses an episode, that means they're completely lost. And Fuller was like, no, because they will all be on CBS All Access, you know? So, yeah. The other thing is I asked Fuller about this later when I interviewed him at the party and I didn't get like the loose lips, drunken loose lips, sink ships information I was hoping for, but he was dropping a lot of hints about working with Shatner and undoing Kirk's death. And so and I asked him about it at the party and he just said, like, you know, it would be great to work with Shatner. So
let's talk about how this can happen.
So, like, I think there's a possibility that they're gonna introduce some third timeline where Kirk didn't die. But that's what he seemed to be hinting at. CBS is definitely very invested in the series doing well as a shiny, shiny lure to get people to subscribe to CBS All Access. And Shatner being on it might be a thing that would work. I don't know. It doesn't have an allure to me. What has an allure to me is Brian Fuller talking about how everyone should, like, you know, put some height in their freak flag, basically implying, I think, that his Star Trek is going to be like a pansexual, like, you know, like as much as Gene Roddenberry pushed the boundaries on diversity with his Star Trek series, Brian Fuller is going to push it even further. It's still a CBS show, but I think, you know, I bet we're going to get like aliens where gender is like a thing. You know, we've already had that, I believe, on Star Trek, but like, you know, where gender is like a fluid thing and like all the other boundaries that need pushing, Brian Fuller is going to do it on this show with this great platform that Star Trek offers writers. So that's more appealing to me than Shatner. But Dave, yes, do explain to us how Shatner could be alive, how James Tiberius Kirk could be alive.
Well, there's a few options. First of all, we don't know when Star Trek Discovery is set. based on the ship design, which is very similar to some stuff done in the late 70s by Ralph McQuarrie and Ken Adams for a Star Trek movie that never got made. That plot, one of those plots that they worked on, had Kirk presumed dead, but he was actually stranded and sort of living a wild lifestyle on an alien planet. So
very Kirk-like.
That is very Kirk-like. It's very possible that that could have happened somehow. But the people who saw Star Trek Generations know that once you leave your imprint on the Nexus, there's part of you that's always in the Nexus. So even though Kirk comes out of the Nexus and dies in that movie, there's always a part of him in the Nexus. Or at least if there's Guinan in the Nexus, then there's always part of him in the Nexus. So you could just techno-babble it out and yank Kirk out of the Nexus. I guess the third thing would be that somehow Star Trek Discovery... I've been trying to look at the call numbers. It's NCC 1301, I believe. But like four call numbers would be in between the original series movie and the Next Generation, because Voyager class ships start having four numbers after the NCC. So I think we're looking at something. We could be looking at something before Kirk disappears into the Nexus, in which case he would show up as an admiral in his red uniform, which would, you know, I'm sure bring fans from Star Trek in the 80s to at least one episode of Star Trek Discovery.
But like demonstrably like decades older and puffier than he was in the 80s?
I mean, he was pretty puffy in Generations. I don't think anybody would notice.
Mm.
Right?
I don't know. I feel like Shatner has had like a whole nother lake of whiskey since then. So
yeah, I feel like when we started this conversation and you said, explain why Shatner is still alive, I was like, that's actually really hard to do. Explaining why William Shatner made it this far.
Yeah, how did Shatner outlive Nimoy? It's a good question.
Here's my closest I got to original cast member story. My grandparents lived down the street from William Shatner in Studio City, California, when I was like 6 to 13. And I have very vivid memories of like knowing what Star Trek is and being freaked the fuck out of seeing fat William Shatner jogging with his dogs. Just being like, Kirk isn't fat. What? Oh my god, my life. So that might have been that, and the Ninja Turtles or guys in costumes might have been like my
of
moments
course,
that broke
of
my
course
life.
Kirk of course no I mean like come on of course Kirk is gonna grow up to be puffy. He's like a drinking ladies man in sort of guy. I mean, like Bill Clinton is always who I think of when I think of James Tiberius Kirk, except Clinton decided to go like vegan and doesn't. But like, you know, like those kind of guys, like, you know, they're going to.
I didn't know that when I was 7. I was just
it's like what Jack Nicholson ended up with and what, you know, how DiCaprio is slowly morphing into him.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of what my original cast member brush of fame was, and I was searching through my memory. I was like, wait, were you at a wedding once with George Takei? And then I was like, no, that's an episode of Party Town. Yeah. So I don't have a story. I was like, I think I was at a wedding with George Takei once. No, that was a television show you watched. Okay. Yeah, so I don't have a story. Not even Next Gen. Nope.
What?
Nothing.
You just like talked to Brent Spiner like 2 weeks ago. You never met like Next Gen people?
I talked to Brent Spiner on the phone, but that's not the same as like being near one physically, right?
I mean, I've always wanted to go to a Star Trek convention. We have a big one out here in Colorado. I've just never like had the time to do a Star Trek only convention. But I feel like then I could get close to a ton of people.
Before I die, I want to get close to Jonathan Frakes.
Oh, I have a pin that's just Jonathan Frakes' face. Like, you can't even see if he's wearing a Star Trek uniform or if it's, like, a Beyond Belief thing. It's just a little pin that's Jonathan Frakes' face. I would love to talk to him.
The Empire podcast, which you guys all know is my obsession, did a great sort of comprehensive 50th anniversary Star Trek episode a couple weeks ago where they all talked about their favorite shows and their favorite movies and stuff like that. And that's where I learned, I did not know, that originally they put Patrick Stewart in a wig when he originally auditioned to be Picard, and it looks horrible, and it's online. So if you want to Google Patrick Stewart wig or Captain Picard wig right now, you can look at it. I mean, it's not as bad as it might be, but it's still like, I'm glad they didn't go with
up
that.
Up until 3 years ago, all the good Patrick Stewart gifts were from Next Generation outtakes, just like all of them. But then he, you know, moved to Brooklyn and got Twitter and things.
Figured out how to make his own damn gifts.
Yeah, that's right.
Things got weird. But yeah.
So I think we're all interested in Discovery. Joanna knows the most about it, which is, you know, what she was talking about it being serialized. But what we've all seen at this point is Star Trek Beyond. Justin Lin's attempt to bring some of the feeling to Star Trek, and to me mostly succeeding, because like I mentioned on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, if you've heard that, I think that the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies, or the Kelvinverse, I'm sorry, I have to keep hammering that into my mind, go really fun, absolutely morose, and therefore not worth watching again. And now this one, I feel like we got back to really fun, to the point that I was smiling throughout the whole Beastie Boys sequence at the end.
I love the Beastie Boys sequence.
I really think it's like the make or break on whether or not you're like with this movie or not.
Well, it's funny. I don't think we talked about this on air. I don't think I'm repeating myself in Fighting the War Room. I think we talked about it off air. But I saw Beyond yesterday with my dad, because my dad was an original series fan. So I was like, hey, Dad, want to go see Star Trek Beyond with me? And my dad was tapping his foot during the Beastie Boys sequence, which is really cute. But my dad, anytime you take my dad to something, play, movie, whatever, he always complains about the second act problem. He's like, that had a second act problem. That is, you know. And when the movie was over, I was like, did you like it? I was like, he did. And I said, I think it had a first act problem. And he said, yes, exactly. Like, so I did not really love the first half of the movie, and I really, really liked how it all came together. So I liked it more than Ghostbusters. I'll give it a B+, probably. But I think the first half was kind of rocky. And Dave was educating me on this, and then I studied up a little bit more on this. But, of course, they started out with a different script and a different director. And both those things got scrapped, but they decided not to change their release date because to not lose the juice of the 50th anniversary. So like Simon Pegg had to whip together the script and Justin Lin was brought in to direct and they just kind of had to go with it. So I think what you see on screen, this is Dave's hypothesis, what you see on screen is just sort of like a bit of a rush in certain things. And also I once again, I was listening to the Empire podcast and I think it was Carl Urban was talking about because of that rushed nature. He said the vibe was almost like an independent film, that Justin Lin had to be really creative in how he did some of his shots because they were just working so fast. And I think that was not that successful in, at the very least, the early action. I thought the early action, the crashing and destruction of the Enterprise, was incomprehensible. Shaky cam, worse than Captain America Civil War, bad action. Anyway, those are my initial thoughts. But I love the Jayla character a lot. I thought Sofia Boutella was great. I thought the Idris Elba reveal was great. Yeah, so those are my thoughts.
I think the first part reads with the same problems I think that the scripting does for the Idris Elba part, which is, if you're building a movie around moments and you find yourself with a really cool concept, which the swarm ships attacking the Enterprise is, I imagine you like get to the editing bay with like way too much of stuff that you thought was cool, because all that's cool. But then you're like, oh, God damn it. Now this has to all happen like in one sequence. So like, okay, the nacelles go down and they cut its throat and there are three different ways to evacuate the ship. And Kirk does it unnecessarily because he like evacuates and then immediately has to go back to the saucer section. So I feel like the impetus was swarm ship attacks in this like, you know, they get lured in this trap and then we have to feel how sad it is that the Enterprise goes down, but that Kirk doesn't do anything wrong like his father. and then they just built this action sequence that got out of control. Which you can kind of feel with like the motorcycle action sequence too. Where like he rides a motorcycle around. They're like, oh man, this is gonna for 10 minutes he rides a motorcycle around. They're like, yep, for 10 minutes. They can't hit him for 10 minutes.
I did like the anthropomorphizing of the ship, which they've always done, but like I love when they call ships like, you know, by the female pronoun and like cut her throat. It was just like a really good line, I thought. But yeah, I thought the evacuation process was really incomprehensible, and like it's clear that things are cut because Chekhov and Kirk show up in different uniforms than they were wearing when they got in the escape pods. So like, unless they did a quick change in the pod or like, you know, it's like their stuff was cut, and that's fine. It's not the end of the world. But anyway, I thought that was pretty confusing, and Star Trek can be better than that. And I think it winds up being better than that. The other thing that I thought was interesting is Carl Urban was saying that, he did not want to do this movie. He got an offer to be in a different franchise. He didn't say what, and he had to choose between the two. And basically he sort of held Star Trek ransom by saying he needed Bones to have a bigger part and not be as marginalized as he felt Bones has been in other movies. So I think the whole Bones and Spock, like, stuff, and he wanted Bones to, like, have a lot of medical stuff to do, and he wanted the Kirk-Bones relationship to be less implied and more explicit. And so, like, I think that's why we get the Bones and Kirk drinking scotch scene, which I was watching and I was like, this feels unnecessary. So I think all of that has to do with Carl Urban sort of like holding Simon Pegg hostage. And they all talked about how they worked with Simon Pegg to like shape the characters the way that they thought they should be shaped, which is must have been hell for Simon Pegg.
Well, I mean,
to juggle all of that.
Is a callback to 5, right? Because he gets him Romulan ale on his birthday. So it's like the thing I liked about this movie was how it winked at previous Star Trek things without bringing everything to a stop. And that definitely, that drink with Bones on Kirk's birthday is good. But then it's like this movie also has to live with being its own thing. And I feel like the rush to put it together, like Justin Lin, he latched on to one line that's said to Kirk, which is like, in space it's like hard to find your orientation, and he's like, that's gonna be Kirk's journey, that's gonna be my camera's journey, that's gonna be his journey.
That is, I think that's probably the only problem that I had with the movie, is that there were a lot of very dizzying camera movements, and I'm like, dude, you can't do this in space, this is not good, this is not gravity. So yeah, so maybe that was, you know, the movie's only really done. I thought it was fun. Like, I actually really liked the self-awareness of it, because, you know, this is something we kind of learned from The Force Awakens, in that, I'm bringing up Star Wars in a Star Trek discussion. Apologies to everyone. But there has to be some self-referential humor to it, because these things are fan fiction. They are fan service. And I really like the little joke about it, his life feeling episodic. And stuff like that, that I think it really comes off as Simon Pegg's sense of humor as a hardcore Star Trek fan. You know, you can tell that this was written by someone who really loves a lot of that original series. And I think that, to a certain extent, I think that Justin Lin succeeded. It forced him into succeeding where the movie is much tighter than I think even Abrams' first one in this new timeline was. It's a much tighter story, and it moves like a Fast and Furious movie, which is meant as a compliment. Like, it moves very quickly, and it feels very brisk, and I walked out of it thinking, well, that was really fun. Like, I'm not, and that's kind of all Star Trek needs as a movie right now, because you can't, it's funny, as I was watching it, the first thing I thought as the Enterprise was going down, I'm like, this again? Like, they have to destroy the Enterprise in like every movie now?
Right, right.
But if you think about it, you know, the show Discovery will have the space to do things that don't involve destroying the Enterprise every week. But these movies have to be, they have to fit into this sort of spectacle level event style storytelling. And I think it really works when it's a little bit more fun and you're rocking out to the Beastie Boys at the end during this potentially apocalyptic thing. And I think when you look at like summer movies, one of the things people seem to be growing tired of is the apocalyptic stakes of every big movie. The, you know, every time the Earth is about to get destroyed. And this is one of those movies where the stakes are there, but you're also having a ton of fun, so you don't feel the weight of that. And I think that's what it accomplishes really, really nicely. And so, yeah, I dug it.
And I think it's more interesting to me to have those apocalyptic, enormous stakes in space. Like, it makes sense that it's like a whole planet-sized sort of space station that is in peril and that you see a million little ships. I did not see, like, I saw it coming, you know, eventually when he's like, we need a large sound. I'm like, okay, great, great. A callback to what came before. But as the swarm was headed towards the planet, I was like, how the fuck are they going to fight this swarm? Oh my God.
They did a good job of establishing that that swarm was like intense, like was extremely dangerous.
And, you know, John Cho mentioned that he wanted Sulu to have a family life, that like the Sulu being gay was something that the studio brought to him, but that he really wanted Sulu to have a family life because we've really only seen Sulu in work mode. Like, unlike a lot of the other characters, he doesn't have like a development outside of work mode. So as brief as it was, he wanted Sulu to have a family. And then that did give it personal stakes, because every time you cut to John Cho's face, you know that he's thinking about his husband and his daughter on the space station. And like, as opposed to like, I don't know, Chekhov's girlfriend or whatever else is on the station, like that really anchors
show,
it with like real
world
stakes.
They show the husband and the daughter running at one point, which I thought was a nice little callback.
Yeah. I thought that was like the right amount of personal stakes in this large, galactic confrontation. But yeah,
on top
I mean,
of
like
needing to save Greg Grunberg.
It's so funny. I didn't even know he was in this movie. And the way I found out is I was walking down the promenade of San Diego and Greg Grunberg was like doing an onstage event with like, I don't know, movie phone. I don't know. It was like some roped off on a stage event that I wasn't even like paying attention to, but I could hear the voice and it was Greg Grunberg, obviously. And I just kept walking and then he's like, yeah, and Star Trek Beyond out. And I was like, oh, I guess Greg Grunberg's in Star Trek Beyond. Makes sense. But I didn't know that. So yeah.
I did not pick Greg Grunberg and Beastie Boys to be the two things that would cross-pollinate between Star Trek and Star Wars when my youth has been unexpected. Did you guys watch Enterprise?
No.
Oh man.
In fact, I'm such a like shameful Star Trek nerd that I didn't know until the panel I attended at Comic-Con that Enterprise is like a prequel and that Scott Bakula's captain was like the first captain. I didn't know that.
So in this ship, the USS Franklin came from that era, correct?
It came predated that era. So here we go.
Okay.
Let's do this now. You guys aren't going to understand it, but for people that watch Enterprise, they're going to really enjoy this.
I'm ready.
Dave,
I'm ready.
How could the NX-326 USS Franklin be a USS ship but predate the Federation? And wasn't the Enterprise the NX-01, the first Warp 5 ship? And doesn't Scotty say that this was the first Warp 4 ship? What's going on? Well, guys,
I'm already lost. Okay, sorry.
It turns out the Franklin was a Mako ship. They were the military that predated the Federation in Enterprise. Enterprise ends with the establishing of the USS United Federation of Planets. So before that, there was like a military group called the Makos that was like the Earth's star force. And one of the exploration ships was the first Warp 5 ship, the NX-01, the Enterprise. But after they became the United Federation of Planets and they started putting USS and United Starship in front of all of the names because it was Federation, they also had to go back and rename all the Mako ships, which is how this NX that was Warp 4 and predates the NX-01 Enterprise is still a USS ship, guys. Isn't that cool?
Yes.
That's way right, cool.
That's but it's super good job. Cool.
It's cool that this Enterprise is shared canon between the two universes. That, you know, if you're going to watch one show that applies to both things, that show is the least popular one.
I mean, it bums me out that, like, Bakula gets no respect, I have to say, since I love Bakula. Like, what during the Comic-Con panel, like, I think someone asked a question about, like, who's your favorite captain? And I think all the captains got a mention except for Bakula, and he's sitting right there. And there was another instance where they were, like, talking about who they would want to bring back or whatever, and, like, nobody talked about Bakula. And I was just like, I wish his series had done well, because I love Scott Bakula at the head of a sci-fi series. So, yeah, bummer.
Bummer.
I also never watched Voyager, despite being like a social justice warrior. I should have been all there for the female Captain Janeway, but I was not.
Well, and so. Seven of Nine. But I guess you wouldn't have known to even look for Seven of Nine at that point.
Well, I know. I was aware, like, Seven of Nine and Janeway were the two things I was aware of, and the bald guy were the two things I was aware of.
He's a hologram.
Yeah, the bald hologram were the two things I was... I have watched episodes of Voyager. I must have.
Well, the bald hologram's in First Contact, so I don't know if you get credit for that.
None of this makes any sense to me.
Here's what you need to know for Game of Thrones. Prince Doran is in Deep Space Nine. So,
what?
Yes.
Now I have to go watch Deep Space Nine.
Dr. Julian Bashir... Dreamy,
oh, that's right.
Dreamy.
I knew that.
Yeah,
he's the best. And the episode that he spends in the Next Generation crossover is also great, because Bashir loves Data for obvious reasons. And
yes.
Those two characters should have hung out more. I was talking to Joanna a bit, I think, off show last night, how smart it was to take Scotty and turn him into Geordi and take Jayla and make it Data and just use that dynamic, which I always thought was a better functioning dynamic than the original series Scotty, which was always just underestimating his ability to do things to make himself look better, which is canonical, by the way. He tells that in Next Generation that you're supposed to pretend it's going to take longer.
And Scotty and Chekhov both got to be O'Brien in this movie. No, I'll bring this back to Buffy, as I am fond to do, which is that when I was in high school, I was pitching a friend of mine who was a hardcore Star Trek nerd. I was pitching her on why she should watch Buffy. And I was trying to explain the Anya character, Anya being this ancient vengeance demon who was trying to understand humanity. And my friend Danielle was like, oh, she's the Data character. And it was like the first time I think that I really understood prototypes of characters. And I was like, she is the Data character. And yeah, Jayla is definitely the Data character. I loved Sophia Batella. I loved that character's look. I loved the way she talked, which wasn't just her accent, but, like, you know, weird switching of words and stuff like that. I thought it was really, really, really good introduction of a character, and really, really great to now have not just one token female, presumably, on the USS Enterprise. But, you know, I mean, forget Alice Eve's character.
Multiple token females.
But yeah. Two. I mean, two women out of a sea of men. Like, that's better,
well,
you know?
No, yeah. So. Because until Star Trek IV comes out, which we're getting to right now, she could go the way of Carol Marcus and just never show up again.
I doubt it, because I think that character's been, like, universally well received, whereas Alice Eve's character, like, nobody cared.
Unless Hollywood gets smart and takes my idea that Sophia Batella and Kate McKinnon should do a buddy cop comedy together.
But, okay, so what we know about Star Trek IV is that Chris Hemsworth is coming back as George Kirk, which is great. I mean, there was some great stuff in this movie about Kirk thinking, I mean, Kirk and his dad has been a theme throughout. They've done a good job of that not just being like a throwaway opening sequence of the first movie, but it being like a thing for this Kirk, for both Kirks, but for this Kirk.
No, it's the thing that differentiates this Kirk from other Kirks, is this Kirk grew up trying to be his father.
Right.
Not trying to impress a person that was there, but trying to impress a person that wasn't there. And that's why he's so much more brash, I feel.
So, I like that. So in my dream version of this movie, which we don't know how they're going to pull off bringing Chris Hemsworth back from the dead, it's going to be like, to go back to Bacula, it's going to be like an episode of Quantum Leap where Scott Bakula's character leaps back into his dad. It's not into like his dad's war buddy in Vietnam. So he gets to hang out with his dad, but he can't tell his dad that he's his son. Like, I want there to be a time loop where Kirk has to be with George, but not tell him that he's his son, but just sort of like, and then they have like a buddy adventure where Kirk is feeling all the feels, but can't explain to his dad why he's feeling all the feels, and just have that dynamic, be really, really strong. But of course I want the entire Enterprise to be in this movie. So I don't know quite, you know, if all of them, I guess, go through a sort of, wormhole back in time or something like that. And also, I think it should be centered around the ultimate destruction of the Kelvin, which is his ship, and Kirk knowing that he can't stop his father's death, right? It's just like we talked about with Harry Potter. Like, that's a very poignant story, right? If, like, he's there, I think the same thing happens in Quantum Leap. He's there, but he can't stop his father's death. So he just has to, like, stand by, and Chris Pine can give good cry. So I really want to see this, you know.
I like your idea of them sharing a mission in the past more than I like the idea of the having to watch his father's death again. I feel like,
well, like ending in that, or like not warning his father. Maybe that's like a Back to the Future thing. I don't know.
Oh no, I would like them to do it. And then that's how the fourth movie ends, is he saves his father and unwrites himself.
What?
Oh, and then the franchise is over?
Well, then we just don't know. But, you know, given how the box office on this one went, they maybe get one more.
And, it's, and they either, cut it's to, like, do... Shatner.
I thought it was moderate success.
It is the lowest opening box office of any of the Abram Treks. It's not as bad as...
But it's not an Abram Trek, that's why.
Or the Kelvin Treks, I'm sorry. Universe name, shame, strike number three for Dave. But it's not as low as, like, your Insurrections or what have you. It's not as low as the bad Next Generation movies, from what I understand. So it's on that line. The thing is, we're entering a period of time where, you know, the Trek rights are owned by two companies. And the television one psyching up, and the movie one seems to be settling down a little bit. I don't know. Critical reaction to Beyond's been good. We'll see how Discovery goes. And J.J. Abrams, at least, is very excited and can't stop talking about this fourth Star Trek movie, rather than, you know, actually get people to see Beyond. But whatever, J.J. Abrams. You promote you however you want.
You do you, J.J.
That's right.
I would like Justin Lin to not come back, if at all possible.
I mean, I think it'd be
I would be okay with Simon Pegg writing the script.
Yeah, I think it'd be.
I thought it was funny. You know,
I think it'd be good to get a director on that's going to do something. I mean, thus far they've been doing okay with vague echoes of where things should be in the timeline. So, like, this would be right after the television show finished, but before Star Trek: The Motion Picture. And then, you know, the fourth original timeline movie also involved time travel, but we had to save the whales. we'll see how they decide to echo this one out. I wrote a parody thing on, like, my Tumblr blog when Into Darkness came out about how, like, the eighth J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie was just going to be a crazy city on the edge of forever redux. They could do that now. That could be what happens. Is there anything that you guys are really looking forward to in the Star Trek franchise more than the other? Are we movie people? Are we show people?
I like this movie franchise. I didn't hate Into Darkness as much as most people. Wait, can we play a game?
Yes.
Can we say on the count of three which director we want to have on Star Trek 4? We can think about it for a second. I'll talk about the movies for a second. I like how they handled Leonard Nimoy's death, and I already said this on Twitter, but I knew the title card that said For Anton was coming, and I still cried. And I cried when, during the scene when Kirk toasts the party and he says to absent friends, and the camera cut to Anton Yelchin. I don't know if that was already in the movie. I feel like it must have been, or I don't know, but it was a lot. And then we walked out of the movie and my dad had not heard anything about Anton Yelchin. So I was like crying in the lobby, telling my dad about how Anton Yelchin died while normal summer moviegoers were trying to like get out of the multiplex. And I was having like an emotional meltdown about it. And this older couple behind me, every time he showed up on screen, the lady kept going, "I think that's the guy who died." And I wanted to turn around and be like, "It was. It's sad. Stop talking You're about it right helping. Now." but of course, in Star Trek IV, there will be no Chekhov. They will not be recasting Chekhov. There is a question, like, are they going to kill him off in the franchise? I hope not. They're obviously going to make a mention as they handled Leonard Nimoy's death so beautifully in this movie. I think they're going to make some mention as to what Chekhov is doing. But I hope it's like, I don't know, living happily ever after with one of those alien girls that he was talking to on the space station. So,
oh yeah, right. Give him his own command. There's a ton of good ways to get out of it. I'm interested. I want them to bring an animated series character in to be a helmsman.
Dave has like an alien helmsman that he wants to have in the
series. Series, you know.
okay, are you? Did I stall long enough,
yeah.
Neil?
Yeah, I'm good.
All right, on the count of three. One, two, three.
JJ
Jonathan Frakes. Okay, so we've got JJ, Michelle McLaren, and Jonathan Frakes. So those are our options. Let us know who you want to have direct Star Trek 4.
Mine would be best. I mean, let us know what you think.
Mine would be best.
Oh, is there anything we need to say about Star Trek?
Probably Neil's would be best. Yeah, it feels like kind of a possibility. He's like, why is he talking so much about this movie? I mean, I know he's still a producer.
He doesn't have a whole lot else going on at the moment.
Yeah, and he's already said that he like kind of regretted stepping away from Star Wars, like saying that he was going to be one and done with Star Wars. So maybe he wants to get back into a star movie.
I think I'm done hoping that J.J. Abrams gets to do everything he wants to do. I was way on his side with Super 8 being like, hey, if you want to go do your Spielberg love note, do it. But then he did Star Trek, then he did Star Wars. Now he could do whatever he wants. I'm like, you know what? Whatever, J.J. Abrams. Just make sure you really want to do whatever you do next.
So you're basically where Guillermo del Toro fans are.
Basically. Oh, God. Yeah.
Whatever, man. Just make whatever.
Just commit to something.
Stop
and
promising
do it,
us
and,
stuff.
Like, I'll watch it, but I'm like, come on. You don't need to keep selling me on new things.
JJ, make me an Alias movie. Give Jennifer Garner a multi-billion-dollar franchise just to make Ben Affleck feel bad about himself. That's what I want.
Yeah, or do what Steven Spielberg did in the middle of his career and just go off and get good things made with the swing of your name and don't do anything yourself. That's also good.
Well, I feel like he's doing that. I mean, whether or not your mileage may vary on good, but like he's like a lot of TV shows are under the J.J. Abrams umbrella, like Roadies,
oh, yeah.
Like things you wouldn't expect, you know.
Cloverfield exists just to elevate people. So he's on his way. He just also doesn't need to be doing things necessarily. I just don't want him to half-ass things. I feel like Into Darkness, like he didn't want to do it. We didn't want it from him. And then afterwards, he's like, yeah, you guys were right. I didn't really want to do it. I put too many lens flares in. It didn't need to be a secret. I'm sorry. It's about 9/11. I realize it's been like 8 years.
I haven't watched a lot of the original series movies. I've watched The Whales one. I've watched Wrath of Khan. I think I've seen Search for Spock.
Undiscovered Country?
I was about to say, I think I'm going to watch Undiscovered Country tonight. Like, I haven't watched that one, and I think I should.
I like that one. It has some cheesy stuff, but I like it.
I think they quote Shakespeare a lot in that one, and I liked that there was a Shakespeare quote and a joke about a Shakespeare quote in Star Trek Beyond. So
you'll meet another guy named Worf played by Michael Dorn, but it is not the Worf.
I heard about that. Yeah. He's his father, right?
It's a Worf. Okay. It's not Moog who is Worf's father, because he's okay. very specifically name-dropped in Next Generation a lot when he's trying to earn his honor back. But they are somewhat related. I think they're like grand or cousins or something.
Cool.
Klingons are weird. But you get to see a Klingon trial, which is great.
All right. Wait, is that the one with Kirstie Alley?
Yes. And then there's also Anti-Gravity.
Oh, I have seen that one. No, I've seen that one. But a long time ago, and I'll watch it again. Neil, do you have a favorite Star Trek movie? It's Star Trek. J.J. Abrams Star Trek.
No, I mean, it's probably Wrath of Khan. Wrath of Khan's amazing. Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, it's hard to beat.
So, yeah, but I would think, you know, of the Kelvin timeline, the new one's my favorite. I liked it. I liked it even more than the 09 one, which I saw sitting two seats away from Leonard Nimoy, so that really says a lot.
That does say a lot.
Simon Pegg, I'm sure, would be thrilled to hear that.
Sure to let him know next time I see him.
Yeah.
Dave, do you have a favorite Star Trek movie?
Do I have a favorite Star Trek movie?
Yeah.
I mean, I like them all for different reasons. If I want my Enterprise porn, I could still watch the first one, which is weird. That is not as boring to me. And then the only one that I can't stand, I'll do this. Here are the Star Trek movies I don't want to rewatch. Original Five, Next Generation, Insurrection, and Nemesis. Everything else, I'm down for a Star Trek movie anytime. Oh, yeah, sorry, Into Darkness should also be on that no list.
Darkness has some good moments.
But I did just watch your favorite First Contact this week.
And it's so good.
It is great.
It's great. Jonathan Frakes, man.
And then, oh man, why did I watch it? I watched it because I also watched the Next Generation episode. No, the Deep Space Nine episode where Cromwell plays an alien in like full makeup that says he knows where Worf's family is. And I was like, is that is that Zefryn Cochran, like under a whole bunch of makeup? And it totally was. But pre-babe Zefryn Cochran, when he had to slum it in full makeup on Star Trek.
I think there's a slideshow of the people who have played two characters in Star Trek, two or more characters, because there's a lot of them, because it's easy to do, because a lot of times you're under so much makeup. So the same is true of Buffy.
Pretty sweet. All right, guys, it's time to pivot. Pivot hard into a preview for next week's stop for Storm of Spoilers. Neil, where are we going next week?
Next week, we're going to Anvil, Texas.
Yeehaw!
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to be talking about a little show.
Uh-huh.
That's steaming up the summer. Uh-huh. Preacher.
Son of a Preacher, man.
And we're also going to be talking about the adaptation of Preacher, because it used to be a comic book, but now it's just a TV show.
It used to be a comic book, but once the TV show started, all the comic books spontaneously combusted.
That's how it
just
works.
Just like my original copy of Ghostbusters.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, the finale is next week, right?
Finale is next week, so let's see. Yeah. If you want to prep, there are 10 trade paperbacks for the comic. One of those is entirely a flashback about the Saint of Killers, which is especially going to be relevant for our discussion of the adaptation. The adaptation thus far has mostly set itself before the first issue of the comic starts and adapted some of the pieces. So yeah. I would say watch the show, read maybe that Saint of Killers one-off. I believe it's volume 4, but definitely it's called the Saint of Killers. And then watch the 10 episodes of the show on AMC. I got myself a season pass on iTunes so I could watch all the behind-the-scenes features, too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, an SD version of that is like $13. Come on, guys. You like TV?
Yeah, guys, just,
like TV.
Just binge-watch 10 episodes between now and next week. It'll be fine. I will say that this season has been a little up and down. I love characters. I love the actors playing the characters. I think this season has been a little up and down, and I think it will reward binge-watching. So,
there are some episodes that were absolute trash, and I would like thought about like maybe not watching it anymore, but then like the next week would have a single moment, and I'd be like, oh, fuck. They've got me again.
Okay, so Dave's not really selling the binge watch experience necessarily, but my overall view is a little more positive, and I think that you'll enjoy it even more if you binge watch it. So
you guys can binge watch it with me because I have like 5 episodes to catch up on.
Or you can just come in without having read or seen anything and just enjoy being lost in the shuffle with us. Storm of Stoilers continues its tour. Also, we're taking suggestions on Twitter. You guys have been good about sending them, but keep sending us suggestions of other geek properties or non-geek properties that you would like us to visit. Preferably something that's an adaptation and something that's somewhat timely. Like, we're probably going to save our American Gods until 2017 because, you know, Neil wants to read the book, and that's when the show will premiere. So we want to sort of make it a little timelier. So think on it. Give us suggestions. We welcome them.
Excellent. So until next time, we all write on the internet. It's something we do. We make some content. We're gonna tell you guys where you could find it besides the Storm of Spoilers Twitter account at Storm of Spoilers. Neil, where can people find more Neil?
Wow. That's a big question. No, you can find me over at filmschoolrejects.com, where I'll be writing maybe some stuff about Star Trek or Preacher. I don't know. We'll see. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Rejects. I tweet about all kinds of stuff, including politics, so gird your loins.
And Joanna?
You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at JoeWroteThis, where I will be writing about any trickle of Game of Thrones info that comes down the pike.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell my first name D-A-7-E. That is also my Twitter handle. I write for Latino-Review.com and Geek.com. Nothing huge Star Trek coming out, but I am going to go back and answer all of your questions you tweeted at me specifically. Pat, I saw your tweets. And would love to continue talking Star Trek with you on Twitter, because, God, I love Star Trek. Oh, man, guys. I mean, like, right now I'm debating whether or not I'm just going to put the Next Generation Enterprise, like, hum over the background of this entire episode, because you better believe I own a continuous loop of it. So, until then, guys, I'm going to use my Genesis on you.
Listen to us next week.